done to me? There's some alien strain consuming my blood.
That's right.
I know that's right. What I want to know is, what is it? Why have you done it?
You're frightened.
You're damn right I'm frightened.
It's natural. You don't know what's happening to you, but there's nothing to be frightened of. As long as you put your faith in me, give me time, trust me.
What have you done to me?
I've given you something you never dare dream of.
What?
Everlasting life.
Junk Food Dinner, episode 14. This week we witness killer rats taking revenge on a gang of marauders in the 1984 Italian post-apocalyptic film Rats, Night of Terror, directed by Bruno Mattei. Then the terror continues as we take a look at Blake Edwards' 1962 stylized black and white investigation thriller, Experiment in Terror. And finally, we get arty with some sexy bloodthirsty immortals in 1983's The Hunger, starring Catherine Deneuve, Susan Sarandon, and David Bowie.
Stupid machine needs a kick in the balls.
Welcome to Junk Food Dinner, episode 14. This is the podcast where each week we scour the internet, video stores, and cable television, looking for the most outrageous and interesting cult films. We're not professional film journalists or critics by any means. We are simply three geeks from Ohio with entirely too much time on our hands. I'm Kevin Moss. I'm joined by my co-host Mark Fredo and this week's special guest host Jason Frisbee. Every week, we'll each bring a cult favorite to the table, recall our personal experiences with the film, discuss its merits, and argue why or why we did not enjoy it. This week, we take a look at Bruno Mattei's 1984 post-apocalyptic killer rats movie, Rats, Night of Terror. Then we examine Blake Edwards' 1962 investigation thriller, Experiment in Terror. And finally, we have the 1983 arty horror romance film, The Hunger. But first, gentlemen, how you doing this week?
Doing well, just really sticky, really hot.
Yeah, absolutely. Jason, I want to welcome you back to the show. As longtime listeners will remember, Jason joined us back on episode 5. And we're happy to have him back in Parker's absence. So, yeah.
Happy to be back. Yeah. Thank you again.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Did you guys have a good 4th of July?
Yeah, it was fine. I just, spent some time with the fam. Nothing too exciting. Cooked out. Good time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I did a lot of that too. Family, cooking out, meaties, beersies. It was good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I spent most of the day blasting MC5 records and drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon. So, you know, America. Rocking.
Yeah. I heard some fireworks, but I didn't see any.
Oh, man, yeah. A friend of mine went down to Indiana and came back with a pirate's ransom of fireworks. So we light them up. I still have a few scabs on my hands from, you know, burn marks from Roman candles and stuff. So I think that's the true sign of a good 4th of July.
Yeah, and some potholes in the backyard. We have a few of those, too.
Yeah. Lots of black rings on your sidewalk from where you're lighting up.
I was just about to say, yeah. In the blacksmith.
All right, sweet. Well, let's get into the nerd news portion of the show. The first piece of nerd news that I wanted to talk about, speaking of 4th of July, was, you know, every 4th of July in recent memory, it's been my, you know, part of my 4th of July ritual to watch the Sci-Fi Network's Twilight Zone marathon that they have every July 4th. I'm a big fan of the Twilight Zone, and like many geeks around the country, I look forward to that day, 24 hours of nonstop Twilight Zone. But this year, Sci-Fi, you shit in our face. You didn't do the Twilight Zone marathon. Instead, 24 hours of The Greatest American Hero.
What?
Yeah, what kind of bullshit is that? I think Sci-Fi
is... But it's appropriate only because of the name, and I understand why they did it, but yeah, that's still ridiculous.
Yeah, I think they've done this Twilight Zone marathon 6 years in a row, and I think this is just continuing Sci-Fi's trend of, like, really trying to piss off their nerd fan base. Like, you know, they put, like, wrestling on, and they changed their name from, you know, S-C-I-F-I to S-Y-F-I, and you know, just a lot of disturbing changes going on at Sci-Fi that I think nerds are not too happy about.
I feel like they have multiple Twilight Zone marathons, don't they? They have one on New Year's.
Oh, yeah, I thought they had one on New Year's as well, right?
Yeah. So yeah, I can understand
using America's holidays.
Right. Well, I think they should have a Twilight Zone marathon every month if I was in charge, but you know, that's just me.
Someday.
It's President's Day. Time for your Twilight Zone marathon.
Right. Now, this is the Forrest Whitaker Twilight Zone that you like, right, Kevin?
Oh, of course, yeah. Fuck that original black and white stuff. Who wants to watch that?
It, Come on.
No, yeah, original Twilight Zone, of course. The next piece of nerd news that I have is it looks like George Miller is planning not one, but two new Mad Max films that are set to be released. For a while, we've been hearing about the new Mad Max film from George Miller that is set to release next year, start filming in a few months. But it looks like he's actually planning it to be kind of like a two-film thing that he wants to shoot at the same time and then release in rapid succession. The first one is going to be called Mad Max Fury Road. He's actually been working on this one for over a decade. He originally wanted Mel Gibson to star in the role that made him famous, but since he's too old and too racist now, they've moved on to British actor Tom Hardy, who recently starred in Inception, to play Mad Max. So, yeah, I guess this is kind of supposed to be a reboot of the series. It's not necessarily a remake, nor is it, I guess, really a sequel. I think it's more just in the spirit of the Mad Max films, but it still has the Mad Max character. So I guess it's going to be part remake, you know, reboot, or however you want to look at it. But it should be interesting to see how this turns out, because George Miller, I thought, you know, I love the original Mad Max films, and it's good to see him get back to his kind of action exploitation roots after, you know, doing the whole foray into children's films with, like, Happy Feet and all that stuff. So nice to see him return to form.
Yeah, I was going to say the second Mad Max film that he's filming at the same time is actually a remake of the one that he's filming as well. So
right.
Covering all of his bases.
Yeah. Well, the second one, I guess, is going to be called Mad Max Furiosa. So
Ooh. You
got Fury Road.
Sounds exotic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that movie must be too exotic for Mel Gibson.
Right. Yeah, did you guys hear about the recent Mel Gibson racist antics that happened? I guess he left a real he left a real racist message on, like, a, what was it, an ex-girlfriend or someone, answering machine?
I think he was just, like, screaming at her and she was recording it.
Yeah, and he dropped some N-bombs and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, Mel Gibson.
Yeah, he's a crazy person.
Yeah, he's really trying to end his career, you know? It's working as hard as possible.
He's definitely not a charming racist like Archie Bunker, so...
There goes Edge of Darkness 2.
We can only hope. But yeah, so new Mad Max. And the only other disappointing thing, though, is I think he's going for a PG-13 rating, which I think is a bad move, because, you know, Mad Max is all about the crazy violence, you know, arms getting run over by cars and people getting their heads exploded. So PG-13, those damn kiddie films got to George Miller. Looking at the broad audience, but, you know, we'll see how that one turns out. The next piece of nerd news that I have, it looks like they have announced who the new Spider-Man is going to be. It's going to be Andrew Garfield, who might not be a household name, but he was in the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, and he made the name for himself in the Red Riding trilogy. But yeah, so it looks like, you know, these are going to be the Spider-Man reboot movies where Sam Raimi stepped away from the director's spot, and they were looking to kind of make a younger Peter Parker focus more on his high school years, but which really doesn't make a lot of sense, because this Andrew Garfield is actually, you know, about the same age as Tobey Maguire was when he took the role of Spider-Man originally. So
I read that they actually are changing it so that he's in college.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that makes more sense. But yeah, because I originally, when they heard about this reboot, that they were, you know, going to kind of focus on the younger Peter Parker and stuff, and that made sense, I guess, in a way, but when you cast an actor that's, you know, in his late 20s, I guess you can't really work that angle.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. I've really lost interest in the Spider-Man franchise. I mean, the first couple movies were good, but, you know, now that Sam Raimi's not attached, I could really care less. I think it's just going to be another superhero movie.
Yeah, less chance for Bruce Campbell cameo showing up in it.
Right. So yeah, we'll see how that one turns out, but yeah, not holding out a whole lot of hope for that one. The next piece of nerd news that I had, it looks like Judd Apatow is working with Paul Reubens to bring Pee-wee Herman back to the big screen. It looks like Paul Rust and Judd Apatow, along with Paul Reubens, are developing a new script for a big screen Pee-wee adventure. So yeah, it'll be interesting, because I know Paul Reubens has tried to bring the Pee-wee Herman character back a little bit. He recently did a live stage show in Los Angeles, kind of going back to the roots of the Pee-wee Herman franchise, and so I guess naturally the next step was to try to get a new Pee-wee Herman movie made. I loved Pee-wee Herman as a kid. I love Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I think it's a sweet movie, but I don't know, a, you know, 50 plus year old Pee-wee Herman I don't know how great that's going to resonate on the screen.
Yeah, I could imagine this being like the movie Funny People, but just with a very neurotic, bow-tie-wearing Paul Rubens walking around. Just yeah. Hours and hours of Pee-wee Herman exposition, just talking about life and how hard it is to not have a bicycle that's been stolen.
Right.
See, I think it could be good. Did you see when, you know, like that iPad commercial? Where he's like in the playhouse and trying to explain to his furniture that he got an iPad and stuff. And I thought, you know, it was funny. It didn't really seem like he had missed a beat. I'm willing to give this a chance.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Paul Rubens actually, for all the shit he's been to, hasn't aged too badly. I mean, the skin's a little saggier than it used to be, but other than that, yeah, he can still pull off the Pee Wee Herman fairly well, which is kind of weird. Like I said, considering the guy's probably pushing 60 and, the character is very childlike. It is kind of bizarre to see him playing it at that age. But yeah, I mean, depending on how Judd Apatow takes it, I mean, like you said, Jason, it may not be far off for him to try to pull like a Funny People-esque Pee-wee movie. But if he keeps it, I guess, true to the original zaniness that made Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Pee-wee's Playhouse kind of so endearing, I think that'll be the best move.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely going to go see it.
Yeah, either way, I'll probably be there.
I'm most definitely going to check it out just purely for nostalgia reasons. So I'm with you guys on that. But yeah, I'm really banking that it's not going to be that zany. Like, as far as Apatow is concerned, it's going to be extremely subtle. Like, hands on your pockets, sort of chatting on the street stuff with Seth Rogen for moral support or something. But
yeah, I'm sure Seth Rogen or, you know, Michael Cera will pop up in there somewhere.
Yeah.
The next piece of nerd news I had now, Mark, I think both you and I are fans of the Not Quite Hollywood, the documentary about the Australian exploitation film industry that came out a few years back. Well, it looks like the director of that movie, Mark Hartley, is making another documentary kind of in the same vein where he's going to set his eye on the Philippines, where a lot of American-funded exploitation films took place as a result of, you know, cheap labor and very lenient rules, which is, you know, kind of interesting because Bruno Mattei, who we're going to talk about a little bit later, definitely used the Philippines to his advantage in a lot of his movies for those very reasons. The movie's going to be called Machete Maidens Unleashed, and like I said, it's going to be a documentary focusing on the Philippines, much like he focused on Australia for the Not Quite Hollywood documentary. So that sounds like it should be pretty cool.
Yeah, that sounds great. That the Not Quite Hollywood documentary that you actually told me about was awesome. It was really great. It just made me want to see, you know, all of those movies. So I imagine this will be a similar situation.
Yeah, I guess they're going to focus from the early 70s into the 90s. You know, a lot of B movies that use the Philippines as a backdrop. So maybe not necessarily homegrown Philippine movies, but more U.S. funded movies that either took place or were shot in the Philippines. So yeah, I think that'll be pretty cool. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of films in that documentary that we're going to have to see and maybe possibly cover on the show at some point.
Definitely.
So yeah, that's set to premiere actually in July this month at the Melbourne International Film Festival, and then I'm sure it'll make its way around the festival circuit and hopefully come to some small theaters near us so we can check that out. If not, definitely on DVD. Okay, and the final piece of nerd news I had this week, I just had to include this just because it seemed so ludicrous, but it looks like Colin Farrell has reportedly agreed to star as Ozzy Osbourne in an upcoming biopic of the Black Sabbath frontman.
God damn it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess Ozzy originally wanted Johnny Depp to play him back in 2003.
I have heard that.
That's funnier.
Yeah, which is kind of stretching out. I think that's kind of vain on Ozzy's part.
He said he liked his accent. He said he thinks he does a good accent. That's why he wanted Johnny Depp.
Yeah, I think, I mean, as far as looks, Colin Farrell's a better fit, but still, an Ozzy Osbourne biopic.
Wouldn't the best fit be Danny McBride with, like, a long wig? I'm thinking that's more like Ozzy.
That would really be the best.
Yeah, but it'll be interesting to see how this turns out. I love Black Sabbath, and, you know, Ozzy Osbourne's an interesting character, but I love rock and roll biopics, so I don't know. I'll probably see this when it comes out, but it It sounds so stupid to me, especially now with, you know, since Ozzy Osbourne's kind of become like a joke of himself with the whole reality show thing. And I think
all
that's
the Warcraft commercials and shit. Yeah, he's really just like a caricature of himself at this point, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if
doesn't
the movie
also,
oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, doesn't he also have a, isn't Ozzy also doing a weekly health column? And the entire basis of this is that he's been to so many doctors over his life that he feels like he can give medical advice to people who write in. I forget which. I think it's either like the Times, and it's either New York Times or a paper out of L.A. I imagine it's out of L.A. But I remember hearing this on NPR recently, and it just sounded ludicrous.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Maybe that'll be like the third act of the movie, is Ozzy getting his his advice column off the ground. Yeah, I mean, if anything, I hope this movie focuses on the Black Sabbath days of Ozzy Osbourne and keeps the you know, anything from 1982 to present you know, as a mere final, you know, afterthought. So I don't know. We'll see how that.
Actually, this is interesting. I just looked it up, and it looks like Jonah Hill is actually going to play Kelly Osbourne.
And Patton Oswalt is Jack Oswald.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get into some cool stuff on DVD this week. Every week, I like to tell you about some of the hot DVDs that will be hitting the shelves of your local stores, as well as online, like Amazon and Deep Discount. Where do you guys buy your DVDs, or do you just steal them?
Steal all the way. Can't even afford it.
I usually, video game and music exchange, buybacks.
Right. Well, so if you are, you know, one of those people that buys DVDs, here are some of the ones that you might be interested in this week. The first one is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo from this year, which came out. This was one that made its way around the art house cinemas and got quite a bit of critical acclaim. It's actually being, it's a foreign film. It's actually being remade for American audience, so I'm sure it'll get more hype when that comes out. But this is the original, finally making its way to DVD. Did you guys see this when it was out? I really wanted to see this in the theater. I heard nothing but good things, but it missed me. So I'm going to have to check this out now that it's on DVD.
Yeah, it was at the Drexel for a while, but I didn't get out there to see it. But I did hear David Fincher is actually doing the remake. So
yep.
That could go either way. But yeah, I would like to check this out. And a couple of my friends read the book, and they said that it was also excellent.
Cool.
Never got to see it. Really interested in seeing it, so I'm glad it's on DVD.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of a murder mystery, and it's supposed to be very stylistic, and yeah, it looks really cool, so I'll have to check that one out. The next one was Brooklyn's Finest, also from this year, starring Richard Gere, Don Cheadle, and Ethan Hawke and Wesley Snipes. Now, this is directed by Antoine Fuqua, who did Training Day, and so I've heard this is kind of along the same lines as Training Day, kind of a gritty cop drama dealing with undercover officers on a narcotics case. So if you like, you know, kind of those gritty crime dramas, I like Training Day a lot, so I'll be interested to see this. This is another one that I missed in the theaters, and I heard Richard Gere is actually pretty good as a real bad lieutenant of sorts, so... I kind of want to check that out. Did either of you guys see this or have any interest in this one?
I thought it looked okay. My friend and soon-to-be roommate Erin was super pumped about it, but I never actually heard what she thought about it. I think she was just pumped because it had like a bunch of people from The Wire in it.
So. Oh.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, a lot of... I know Omar's in it, which is like reason enough to go
right.
So, I don't know. That's another one that I'm sure I'll be renting.
Cool.
Yeah, likewise. Looks really great. I did not get a chance to go out and see it, though.
The next one I saw was a movie called Bitten from 2009. Now, I hadn't heard of this one before. It's directed by a guy named Harvey Glazer. It stars Erica Cox and Jason Mewes, best known as Jay from Jay and Silent Bob, the Kevin Smith movies. But it's about Jack, played by Jason Mewes, who is a night shift paramedic who rescues a troubled young woman from the throes of death. When he brings Danica home to mend, he discovers she's a vampire in need of nightly fix. Otherwise, she's really perfect. But as the victims pile up, Jack questions his own fate and what his growing fear of commitment could cost him. So I guess it's kind of like a vampire love story starring, you know, Snoochie Boochies.
I might skip that.
Yeah, it's probably terrible, but I had to include it just for morbid curiosity. I don't know. If it winds up on Netflix, watching instantly, I might check it out just because I would like to see Jason Mewes in something other than a Kevin Smith movie and see how he fares, but I don't know. Yeah, it sounds pretty retarded.
I feel like Parker will probably watch that, so I'll let him tell me how it is.
Okay. Speaking of terrible movies, the next one on my list was Iborgs from last year, 2009. You guys heard about this one?
No. I can guess what it's about, though.
That's the best name for a movie I think I've ever heard.
Yeah. In the near future, as fear of terrorism escalates, privacy is a luxury of the past. Now in people's homes, on the streets, in the workplace, everyone is constantly being watched by mobile robotic cameras known as iBorgs. But are the cameras just watching, or are they up to something else? As an increasing number of people die in bizarre ways, federal agent Gunnar Reynolds, Adrian Paul from Highlander, is determined to find out. So yeah, it's also got Danny Trejo, who's going to be in the upcoming Machete movie. So that kind of piqued my interest. But yeah, iBorgs, with a name like that, it had to be on.
Oh yeah, it's gotta be fantastic.
Yeah.
I might see that before the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Yeah, put that at the top of your queue.
I was so close with my guess for what the iBorgs were. I was just imagining they were like half man, half eye. But apparently I was wrong.
I kind of thought it was a giant robotic eye. I didn't really care what it in my head. The iBorg was maybe a little different. I don't know. I'll tell you after I watch it.
Awesome.
Sounds good.
The next couple DVD releases are actually TV shows that may be of some interest. The first one is Squidbillies Volume 3. That's the Adult Swim cartoon, you know, hillbilly squids causing more trouble than you can shake a stick at. But yeah, I've actually never seen this show. I know people have said it's funny, and it's like a lot of that Adult Swim stuff, which is just really, you know, just kind of random and bizarre, kind of weird humor. Have you guys ever watched that show?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have. I've seen a couple of episodes, and it is really bizarre in a whole lot of ways, even just comparative animation styles within the show. But yeah, I've got friends who just love it. They'll quote it, and I have no idea even how it relates to the conversation. Completely out of context for me, but...
Right.
Yeah, I've also seen a couple episodes, but have friends who are, like, super into it. I think it's pretty fucking annoying. So I have not bothered to check it out any further.
Right.
But I have a very hot-brow sense of humor. I like, you know, like iBorgs and...
When Nature Calls.
Nature Calls.
Yeah.
No.
And then the other TV series that came out this week was Have Gun Will Travel Season 4, Volume 2. This is actually a show, you know, an old show, I think from the 50s, and I've watched quite a bit of it. I really like it a lot. It's about the adventures of Paladin, a gentleman/gunfighter who preferred to settle his problems without violence, yet when forced to fight, he excelled. So it's, you know, one of those old cowboy TV shows, which... I watched a lot as a kid. I ran on reruns, I think, on Nickelodeon. And, you know, as a young kid, it was something, you know, me and my dad liked to watch together. So, I don't know. I might check that one out. And then finally, we have three notable Blu-ray releases coming out this week. First one is Jason and the Argonauts hits Blu-ray. I thought that was fitting since Jason's on the show this week. It's probably one of the better-known entries featuring, you know, the great stop-motion creature effects by Ray Harryhausen. So just for that alone, I'd say that's worth a Blu-ray upgrade. The next one is a sweet double feature, Dr. Giggles and Otis finally coming to Blu-ray. I think we talked about that back when we did our Dr. Giggles episode. But yeah, that's a good twofer on Blu-ray this week. And then finally, I had to include this because this fucking cracked me up. Last week we talked about how ridiculous it was that Uncle Sam is getting the high-def treatment. This week, I think, even excels that. The Blu-ray release of 1992's Ladybugs, starring Rodney Dangerfield.
Odd.
If any movie needs to be in high def, and
it's Ladybugs.
It's Ladybugs.
Yeah.
If any comedian needs to be in high def, if any aging comedian needs to be in high def,
yeah,
it's Rodney Dangerfield alone.
You will see
all of them.
Yeah, you will see every line on Rodney Dangerfield's face.
Every vein out of his eyes that are bulging out of his head. It's all there.
So yeah, if you...
Well, with Ladybugs on Blu-ray, then, you know, Camp Nowhere, Sidekicks, all that stuff can't be far behind. So maybe I'll upgrade.
Yeah, you should. So yeah, if you just got like a huge plasma TV and a Blu-ray player, what better way to break it in than picking up Ladybugs on Blu-ray? All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Mark is going to tell us all about Rats Night of Terror, so stick around.
What is it about those little furry bodies that's so frightening? Just think of them close to you. Who could stop them and how? Seething, teeming millions, their little red eyes gleaming with rage and hunger. And they're waiting for you.
No! I don't want to die like that! No! They'll eat us alive! They'll kill us all!
Rats, they're waiting for you. Tonight, because this is your night of terror.
Welcome back to Junk Food Dinner, episode 14. We're going to discuss Rats, Night of Terror by renowned Italian director Bruno Mattei. He's actually directed probably 50-ish films and worked on over 100, often under various names, Vincent Donn, Pierre LeBlanc, David Hunt, Martin Miller. He has quite a bit of movies, as I've said before. I've only seen a few, but some of the more known titles are SS Girls, The Nuns of Monza. He did Zombie 3, which he actually co-directed with Lucio Fulci. He passed away in 2007, so not too long ago. He's often referred to as the Ed Wood of filmmaking, and has said on the commentary, actually, on Rats Night of Terror, that he would like to reshoot all of his films because he doesn't like them. If that's not the best review, I don't know what is. This movie takes place in the year 2230, after the world has been destroyed by war, and there are two groups of people. They're the people who live underground, and then the survivors up top who kind of scavenge and hunt for their living. This follows a group of people with hilarious names like Taurus and Chocolate, Lucifer, Deuce, and Video.
And Kurt.
And Kurt.
The badass. Most badass name of them all.
Yeah. Noah.
Right.
So they are rolling into town in their, you know, with their bikes and their bad attitudes, looking for food and a place to lay low for a while. So they roll into this town and pretty soon are confronted by an army of horrible rats. And the rats are upset that they're there, so they eat them. And there's a lot of infighting and finger pointing, and eventually they have to learn to work together if they're going to survive this plague, this veritable night of terror. And there's a lot of really funny dialogue and some awkward sex scenes and lots of fake rats.
Yes. And real rats.
And real rats. Yeah. And a twist ending that you will never see coming. So that's pretty much it. It really all takes place in this one town, really just a couple of buildings.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of cool. You know, this really kind of claustrophobic kind of environment and dubbed dialogue.
Right. Very dubbed.
I'm interested to see what you guys thought of this.
I started off liking this movie a whole lot. The narrative at the beginning, talking about the post-apocalyptic world, that just had me. Plus, there's some neat shots of iguanas. So I was like, rats, probably just some sort of general title. Maybe it's an art symbolism thing. I don't know. But I think once they start exploring the main house that they're in, they find this abandoned building and they decide to go exploring and whatnot. And they split up to go explore the different rooms, this team of wildly dressed miscreants of survivors. Kurt with his neckerchief, it just immediately reminded me of Scooby-Doo Mysteries.
Yeah.
And then as it progressed, I was just like, okay, so this is Road Warrior meets Scooby-Doo Mysteries meets Mrs. Brisby and the Rats of Nim, if the rats ate people. it wasn't as thrilled with it as I thought it'd be, but God, so many of the dud lines and so much of the acting. I would probably watch it again just for those. I watched Noah when he gets set on fire by his teammates, just being half covered in rats. He falls out a window, and then there's a slow-mo shot of him trying to put himself out, and all he does is two push-ups. I must have watched that like 3 or 4 times.
That's one for the AV repeat.
Yeah.
Yeah, overall, I liked it. I thought it was fun. I mean, I had actually read quite a bit and seen actually stuff online about this prior to actually seeing the full movie. This is the first time I had seen it in its entirety, but I had heard quite a bit about it. It has a little bit of a reputation, especially among, you know, cult nerds. But yeah, I thought it was entertaining. The dubbing, of course, is, and you'll get this with a lot of the Bruno Mattei stuff, is kind of distracting for a little bit, but once you can get past it, because, you know, these are all Italian films and the dubbing in English is a little less than perfect. So that was, you know, the first hurdle to get over. Second was the rats. A lot of times, sometimes it looks good, you know, when they use the real rats and stuff. Sometimes the gore effects are pretty cheesy, and sometimes the rats are just so fake it takes away from the quote-unquote terror. But for the most part, I think this was an entertaining movie. I love post-apocalyptic stuff. I mean, and there's tons of that from the, you know, the Italian genre community. They kind of mastered the post-apocalyptic exploitation movie in the 80s. So there's a lot of it to be had if you're a fan of it like I am. And this is definitely one, if you're a fan and haven't seen, you should. So yeah, I liked it. I thought it was good.
That's excellent. Yeah, I have a special place in my heart for, you know, Italian cinema. And this was one that I picked up at the video store. Blue Underground put it out, and, you know, they put out a lot of great, really interesting kind of culty stuff. And, you know, it is post-apocalyptic, and it is killer animals, and it is Italian. So it really kind of struck a chord that I should pick this up. And I had actually seen Zombie 3, so I was kind of ready for it. But, I, you know, like you said, this was in Cinema Sewer, and I guess this was more well-known than I had anticipated. But I think I might end up doing some more Italian stuff on here now that I've, like, eased into it with this. So get ready for Black Belly of the Tarantula and $5 for an August Moon and stuff. So,
right. Now, one thing I wanted to talk about, and I don't know if you had researched this or if you know the answer to this, because I had read some debate online about whether or not any rats were harmed in the making of this film, because there was a lot of scenes where it looked like real rats were used, and, you know, they did a lot of stuff where they, you know, use a flamethrower and stuff like that. And it's very possible that, you know, rats perished in the making of this movie, which, you know, is a big point of contempt for a lot of people. If an animal was killed in a movie, it's, you know, pretty much an unforgivable sin, which I can understand. You know, I don't think animals should be killed for entertainment. But had you read anything about that? Is that confirmed?
I've read, you know, when I was looking stuff up to talk about it tonight, there's a lot on IMDb specifically. There's a thread where some whiny nerd is like, don't watch this. You know, they kill rats or something. But I, one, don't know if they actually killed rats. And two, I don't give a shit if they killed a bunch of rats. So I mean, it doesn't really make much of a difference to me. I mean, if they were shooting dogs dressed up as rats, I would probably not have picked this movie, but you know, whatever. I don't know if they did. I kind of doubt they did, but at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised. But I don't remember seeing no animals were harmed in the making. You know, but I don't remember seeing an all animals were harmed in the making either. So
let me ask you a question. All right, so rats are cool, but dogs are not cool. What about if they killed rabbits or squirrels?
Probably squirrels are okay, but not rabbits.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll make a list. I'll make a list of animals I find acceptable to kill on screen.
Right.
Hopefully we can do a show around that. But yeah, I you know, even if they did kill these rats, those rats would be dead by now anyway, so...
That's a good point.
Like, yeah. Well,
and I'm sure if they did kill them, they ate them.
Right.
Yeah, they give all those great recipes in the beginning. Video does. It's like fried rat tails, baked rat pie.
Yeah, they love vinegar. It.
Well, yeah, I think in a post-apocalyptic world, there would be a lot of rodent eating.
Yeah, exactly. So, and since this was filmed in the future, I think it's safe to say. One of my favorite rat effects, though, was it's towards the end. It's when they're like trapped in that room, but the like rat wave. It's like,
oh, yeah,
a feet of rats that they just like pull. I like that one.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's a lot of kills in this movie all at the hands of these rats, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of very creative ways, and some not so creative ways. I mean, there is a handful of people that just simply get, you know, enveloped by rats, or, you know, get their face bit off or whatever. But I like the one, I think the girl's name was Lilith.
Oh, yeah.
Who had the rat, you know, pretty much tunnel through her.
Yeah. That's rough.
Yeah.
See, a rat would eat you if it had half a chance, so.
Right.
Might as well eat it before it gets
exactly.
you, is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, gain its strength.
Yeah, I liked a lot of the death scenes, too. Probably favorite was Taurus. Is my favorite when Taurus shows up after being attacked by rats, and like, Taurus, how are you doing? And he's like obviously dead on his feet, and then he just falls, and then his back becomes a rat cannon. Like, they just explode onto faces, feet above the ground, and, you know, that was probably the best. My least favorite was any time that just rats were thrown at people. Like, you'd see a rat just tossed.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's... That rat's not jumping, and he's definitely not moshing into the other rats there.
Yeah. Yeah, there were quite a few times when it was obvious that either rats were just being tossed or just like a bucket of rats were being dumped like through a window or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, one thing that I found kind of weird about this movie, and this is also a sentiment that has been echoed on message boards and stuff, but it's like, why could they not escape these goddamn rats? You know, it seems like these rats were confined pretty much to that one building they were in, and they kind of give that flimsy thing where they're like, oh, the rats chewed our motorcycle tires, you know, we can't leave. It's like, you know, you can't walk out of the building to another area where the rats are not as prevalent.
Yeah, just fucking get out of there. Take right. some of that food that you found, take some rats to cook along the way, and just get out.
Yeah, there's no reason why you need to be hanging out in this place.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't get that either. I mean, for survivors, they look extremely world-weary, and by that I mean they look extremely hip. Like, they look like the motorcycle gang from Road Warrior, where they just have all these cool clothes, and it's like, well, fuck, they've been around. They know what's up. They've obviously been able to have their pick of what's left of clothing. in the world, you think they would at least have realized, well, we can't stop in any city because there's rats everywhere. It right. just appears to be this one city, and more locally, that one building. Yeah, it's like, why don't you just hop roofs and be like, all right, let's get some rest, head out in the morning.
Yeah, see ya.
Right.
Sleep in a hammock.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, I would have been a valuable asset to this gang if I were there.
Yeah. Let's just leave, guys.
Yeah. I don't think so, skateboard or whatever my post-apocalyptic name would be.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked Video. He was probably my favorite of the Marauders just because he was a video game expert.
who at one point, doesn't he say, this machine needs a kick in the balls?
Yeah.
And he kicks it in the machine's balls.
Yeah.
Or at least where he thinks they would be. I like how he had the name Video Game, but I'm pretty sure before he messes around with the control board, which he thinks is a video game, he admits to the fact that he's never played a video game, but then follows it directly with, I can win any game in the world. So he's just a snot-nosed kid from The Wizard with the power glove. Just
oh, yeah, survived. Lucas.
Yeah.
This way looks like it. They must have gotten to pick their own names.
Probably.
Well, I'll be Kurt. Yeah, fuck it, I'll be Kurt. Right, so we got Lucifer, Chocolate. You guys got all the good names.
Deus. I'm going to pick that next.
Well, yeah, I guess that about wraps it up. Stick around, because the terror continues when Kevin tells us about Experiment in Terror.
Lieutenant.
The police lieutenant?
He says it's important. Take it on your phone.
This is Miss Sherwood.
Hello, Miss Sherwood.
Yes?
You made a serious mistake, Kelly. You talked with the police.
No, I didn't.
Shut up! What do you think? It's some kind of a game? I'm gonna teach you a lesson. I think Toby'd be interested in a man like me.
Oh, no, please.
All right, welcome back to Junk Food Dinner, episode 14. The next movie we have is Experiment in Terror from 1962. Now, this was directed by Blake Edwards, who was probably most famous for directing Breakfast at Tiffany's. He also directed the Pink Panther movies, and as well as the Peter Gunn TV series, which is actually how I came upon this movie. Recently, Netflix had the entire Peter Gunn collection on Watch Instantly, and I've really started watching that, and it's fucking awesome. If you guys haven't watched it, I really highly suggest it. It's a black and white film noir style cop show from the early 50s, and despite its date, it is extremely violent and very, very entertaining. So I got really into that. I've been watching a lot of those episodes, and I kind of wanted to see, you know, what else was out there. I knew Blake Edwards had done, you know, the Pink Panther stuff and Breakfast at Tiffany's, but I came across this when researching him, Experiment in Terror, and it sounded pretty interesting. So this was actually the first time that I had seen this movie, but I'm glad I did. The plot of Experiment in Terror revolves around Kelly Sherwood, a young, attractive bank worker who one night is accosted by a shadowy stranger who informs her that she will be cooperating with him in a plan to steal $100,000 from the bank that she works at. She's told that she is being watched by him. If she attempts to contact anybody or, call the police, that they'll know about it and she'll be killed. So she better go along with this plan. Immediately afterwards, she tries to contact the FBI. She only gets a few sentences in before, that same shadowy stranger appears in her house and knocks her out and disconnects the phone. But from that information that they got, the FBI is able to finally track her down. Kelly begins a kind of secretive correspondence with an FBI agent by the name of John Ripley, played by Glenn Ford. By the way, Kelly Sherwood is played by Lee Remick. Kelly lives with her sister, Toby, who is a high school student, and she drives her to school every day, and she hangs out at the hangout, the local malt shop. And this shadowy stranger knows all about her, too, and has made several threats against her if Kelly doesn't cooperate in their little game. So throughout the movie, FBI agent Ripley and Kelly have various encounters with the shadowy figure, get more information on this bank robbery that they're trying to pull off, and try to reveal the identity of this menacing terror. So, what did you guys think of this movie?
I liked it a great deal, actually. At first, I didn't really buy into it, and then there's so many points of tension in the film that I could kind of see where I was going, but I still got really suckered in. I think it actually happened within one scene. There's the FBI agents towards the beginning where they get the call, but they don't really get too much information about her. It is her last name Sherwood, right? And then the phone goes dead. And the exact exchange, I was watching this with my girlfriend. We both kind of looked at each other at this. The main FBI agent, one of the other agents says, did she say someone was going to kill her? And our protagonist, the hero FBI agent, says, yeah, she seemed to know what she was talking about. And then they decide to track her down. Because so many people who say they're going to be murdered are usually lying about it. Right. I was thinking that was probably just going to be like, we were expecting to be not very good, but then the tension really picks up. So, yeah, I really like that. All the points of tension in the film.
I thought this was really awesome. I really, really liked this movie. When I put it on, I was like, oh man, 2 hours?
Yeah.
But I was just like completely enthralled. You know, when it started up, I thought I'd recognize the music, and Fantomas actually does this theme on their director's cut album.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I thought that was cool. I thought Lee Remick was banging out of control with her swoopy hair. I thought that the shadowy figure was a total creep. I thought he was really convincing as the creep. I liked a lot of the scenes, and like Jason said, there was a lot of tension. You know, like there were scenes where I was genuinely like, "Get out of there!"
Right.
Yeah.
I thought it just really sold that tension, and I thought the climax at the ballpark was also excellent.
Yeah. Now,
I was really into this, and it was nice to, I feel like I say this on occasion, but it was nice to watch, like a movie of what some people would say like a higher caliber, and I thought it was pretty excellent.
Yeah, now let's talk about the music for a minute. You talked about the main score, which is really great. The opening credits have this amazing music done by Henry Mancini, who did he worked with Blake Edwards a lot. Actually, he did the music for Breakfast at Tiffany's, and he did the iconic Pink Panther theme. But one of my other favorite things that he ever did, going back to Peter Gunn, was the Peter Gunn theme, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard, and just really great. Iconic music that will just really get stuck in your head and really sets the tone for a lot of these movies, which I think is really cool.
Definitely. Yeah, it really sets the mood, you know, I mean, that just the way it starts off, you know, with the, like, wide shot of the city and just that music, you kind of know that, you know, you're in for this, like, tense kind of experience, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought a lot of cinematography was really well done, too. just because I'd been to San Francisco recently, and the city shots were mostly at street level and just seemed very recognizable.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as Mark mentioned, the ending scenes with the baseball game at the baseball stadium are really great. These close-ups of the ball players just were very effective at helping build some of that attention, because you see like how focused they are on the game, and you can imagine that's how focused our heroes are in it too.
Yeah,
and just to set up, you know, to set up a scene so tense in like a just, you know, a huge crowd like that, I thought that mm-hmm. was really cool. And then, you know, just like the panic that you would feel and like just being overwhelmed, and you know, the confusion on the part of the FBI because there's so many people, and I just thought that was a really good climax.
Yeah. Now, with a title like Experiment in Terror, it almost kind of sounds like a horror movie, although it's really not. It's actually, you know, much more of a investigation crime thriller. And that's something that I think this really kind of set the template for a lot of the crime, like cop shows that are on TV now. I feel like, you know, things like Law and Order and CSI really took the formula that this movie kind of paved the way with and ran with it, because it seems like you know, a lot of the investigation scenes, you know, you at first you don't know the identity of this shadowy figure, and the FBI work and the, you know, in a lot of, they go into detail with the investigation process and interviewing different people that may or may not be involved. And I think that whole device has been kind of appropriated in modern times and used a lot, like I said, in like television crime dramas and stuff like that. And so it's interesting to see kind of where that originated.
Yeah. You know, I, as much as I gush about liking this, I did think that some of it was a little superfluous. Like the, I liked the first lady who went to Agent Ripley and said, you know, like, my friend is involved with this bad dude. And then there was that, you know, spooky scene at her place with all the mannequins and
stuff.
Oh
yeah. That was a great scene.
Yeah, that was a really good scene. So I thought that was, you know, that was great and really relevant. But the Asian lady, Lisa, and her son, I was just like, come on, you know, get on with it. And I understand it's like relevance and stuff. And, you know, they used it to track him down and stuff. I just think they could have found a more concise and interesting way to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's really interesting. Oh, sorry. I was actually the opposite. I remember watching the mannequin scene, and she turns. It looks like it's going to be, again, they try to build tension with all these different scenes, and you think it's just going to be this person who's going to attack her, or not even that, but they look like dead bodies. She mentioned she has this interesting profession, and the music kind of builds, and she's walking through, and you're like, she just murders people. There's limbs hanging all over the place, and then you see like that they're polished mannequins, and I was actually kind of lost interest at that point, but as Kevin was saying, with how these kind of build the NCIS and CSI and all the modern cop dramas that we have, for some reason, I thought the interrogation scenes with Miss Sun, I think, and her child at the hospital, I thought those really worked for me for some reason. I just thought it was really interesting how he kept coming back, and you could just feel how just closed off she was getting more and more to this FBI agent coming around and trying to get information from her and her son at the hospital.
Yeah, I mean, at 2 hours, you know, it's over 2 hours long in its running time. I think it's about 2 hours, 3 minutes. It is a little bit over long. I mean, it's hard for me to say anything that I would cut out, but like Mark said, I think maybe a little bit more concise on certain scenes. You know, they might linger a little bit too long at any given time. That would be my only complaint of the movie, because it did take up, you know, a lot of time, I think everything in it was fairly pivotal to the story, it's hard for me to point at any one specific plot device or scene that I think deserved to be omitted, but yeah, maybe just a little bit more concise, trimming those scenes a little bit.
Just tighten it up, because, you know, it's in the middle of all this really tense stuff, and, you know, I was less interested in that than I was in the scene where she's trying to sneak the money out of the bank. You know, and the music in that is this, like, really slow kind of build. And I was convinced that she was not going to get this money out of the bank.
Yeah.
So I thought that was, you know, it was just really well done. When it was tense, you could really feel it. And then when it dragged, I felt like you could feel that just as much because it was so tense in the spots.
Right.
Yeah, I can see, I definitely see that point, especially like how the end is, it just moves along so quick once it starts going. And also with the earlier mention that our villain Red Lynch, he's calling a heroine here and asking, you know, like, where can we meet up, because I know everything about you, even though stuff about her little sister, that she hangs out at the hangout, and that doesn't come up until, like, the very end of the movie, where he kind of exploits that fact and calls the hangout and gets the younger sister to meet up with him, again, creating this interesting kidnapping plot point to it. Yeah, that could have easily have just happened much sooner, but again, like, how would that affect the rest of the cut of the movie? How long would he have kidnapped her for?
Right. What I was going to mention is, it's interesting that this movie actually was a big influence on director David Lynch. Mm-hmm. Several things in this movie which David Lynch took directly. Actually, at the beginning of the movie, they mention that she lives on Twin Peaks. Yeah, that he used. Yeah. There's also some similarities in scenes from Wild at Heart and stuff like that, where David Lynch has kind of used inspiration for this. And like you mentioned, we learn later that the shadowy figure, his name actually is Red Lynch, which maybe that's what piqued his interest in this film initially. Also in Twin Peaks, the full name of the shadowy figure is Garland Red Lynch, and in Twin Peaks, the mayor's name is Mayor Garland Briggs, which is also a nod to this film. So I think that's kind of interesting that David Lynch drew a lot of inspiration from this film, which kind of makes sense when after watching this movie and kind of knowing David Lynch's work.
Yeah, I mean, even some of the, where Red is speaking into the phone, just like the lighting and like kind of some of those shots, it really, you could tell. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another thing I wanted to mention is that the poster for this movie rules.
Oh yeah, very cool.
Yeah. So,
just at the mention of David Lynch, yeah, I caught that Twin Peaks. I think after I made that connection and thought that it was thought that David Lynch's work might be kind of an homage to the stuff, like how Tarantino does most of his work as an homage to grindhouse films, I really just gained a lot more of appreciation for the characters in this movie for not being so naive as some of Dave Lynch's characters, like in Blue Velvet, where they're just like young 50s kids who don't know any better and they're just running around town and get kind of worked over. Yet the people in this film know the consequences and what might happen when dealing with this lunatic, and they discuss it, which again results in a lot of exposition, but I thought that was cool too. They're very much aware of the trouble that they're in.
I was just going to say, you know, at one point, she's really just fed up with this guy and snaps at him on the phone, you know, and that was another thing that I just wasn't expecting, is where she is just like, you know, you listen to me, you know, when he calls to yell at her about not being, you know, where he told her to meet, even though she was, and all that happened. But, yeah, I thought that was, yeah, she seemed, everybody just kind of seemed more aware of what was actually going on.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of what sets this film apart for me is, you know, the time that this was made, the early 60s, a lot of times when you were dealing with crime dramas and things of that nature, I think this kind of took its cue from a lot of the film noir stuff, which was a lot more steeped in reality. A lot of times in the early 60s, there was, especially in Hollywood, there was kind of that thing where they tried to, you know, kind of sugarcoat a lot of the crime elements of it, make the characters very naive. They weren't very realistic. There wasn't a whole lot of violence, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, this was very gritty, especially for the time. The way that the Red Lynch character, the way he threatens and intimidates Kelly is very, I think, bold, especially for the time. I think he even calls her a bitch at one point, which I think was fairly, you know, taboo for the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of really good, you know, realistic elements to it, which I think is why this movie stands up so well, despite being almost 50 years old. You know, it's in black and white, but I think it's very stylized. I think the cinematography is great. And so I think even now, even if you're not a big fan of black and white movies, and you don't really go back that far in terms of the films that you enjoy, I think this is definitely one to look into, because it does feel very modern in a lot of aspects. And like I said earlier, it set the template for a lot of modern investigative crime thrillers. All right, well, I guess that wraps up Experiment and Terror. Stick around. We're going to take a quick break, and Jason is going to tell us about The Hunger. So stick around.
Melanie Ghost is dead. The bats have left the bell tower. The victims have been bled. Red velvet lines. The black box. Melanie Ghost is dead. I'm dead, a virginal bride. I'll pass this tomb, strewn with types and flowers, bereft in deathly bloom, alone in a darkened room. Bela Lugosi is dead. Bela Lugosi is dead. Bela Lugosi is dead. I'm dead, I'm dead, I'm dead. I'm dead, I'm dead, I'm dead.
Sarah Roberts is in jeopardy.
Hey, lady, how about it?
Stay with her. Help her, for she has begun to feel the awful horror of the hunger. John Blaylock, the hunger has given him everlasting life. Until now, pray for him. Miriam Blaylock, she feeds one day in seven on the unsuspecting. And soon she will turn into something that you will never be able to forget. No matter how hard and how long you try, fear her.
What have you done to me?
Forever and ever.
And life signs terminate right here.
What am I going to do?
Timeless beauty of Catherine Deneuve. The cruel elegance of David Bowie. The open sensuality of Susan Sarandon. Combined to create a modern classic of perverse fear. Mysterious, sensual, strange, perverse, riveting. The Hunger.
Welcome back to episode 14 of Junk Food Dinner. My name is Jason Frisbee. This is The Hunger. It's a 1983 film starring Mr. David Bowie, Catherine Deneuve, and Susan Sarandon. And while the film purports to carry Willem Dafoe, he only shows up for half a minute.
Yeah.
Be forewarned. To give you an idea of the plot of this film, it's not a typical vampire film. There are undead in it, and they do look like vampires, and they do go hang out at goth clubs and listen to goth bands, as we probably might have assumed that 1980s vampires did. But in this case, they do not have fangs. Instead, they stay immortal by preying on the young, the club-going community. And that's with John, David Bowie, and his lady immortal, which is the Catherine Deneuve of Miriam. And early on in the film, we see kind of how they met through these flashbacks and what they've been doing. Basically, it's just sustaining each other. John obviously loves Miriam. Miriam doesn't really say much back. And Miriam then sees a doctor on TV. That's Susan Sarandon. He's playing Dr. Sarah Roberts. And she falls instantly in love. Once she falls in love with Susan Sarandon, it appears that David Bowie is on the wane and loses his immortal ability. He goes to seek out the doctor's assistance because she's researching aging as a disease. She doesn't really believe Bowie, who seems to be aging quite quickly. He ages about 50 years in one day. And that definitely, so she goes to visit Miriam and finds her attractive as well. And then the plot just spirals into artsy, lovey-dovey, curtain-blowing sensuality after that. And, yeah, so what do you guys think about this film?
When it first started, I thought, and I had not seen this film prior to watching it for this week's episode. When it first started, I'll be honest, I really thought I was going to hate it. It starts off, and we get a lot of that very arty editing, very quick cuts. And it starts off with, a lot of music by the band Bauhaus, which, whatever, I'm not a huge fan of. But I thought it was going to be real arty and real, just kind of annoying, which it kind of was in some aspects. But as the movie progressed, I actually started to like it a lot more. I thought a lot of the special makeup effects that when they showed David Bowie's rapid aging, I thought were really cool and done really well. But it kind of lost me again at the end. So it was like one of those movies where like the beginning and the end I wasn't too crazy about, but like the in-between part I liked quite a bit.
Yeah, this is one that I've actually seen a few times. I think this is probably my third or fourth time seeing it. I first saw this movie as goth high school Mark because I was, goth and super into Bauhaus, and someone said, you should see The Hunger. So I saw it and Bauhaus was in it and... I liked it, but then I had seen it again a couple other times. They showed it at either Nightmare at Studio 35 or Schlock Around the Clock or something. So I saw it there a couple times, and other Bowie-obsessed fans or Bowie-obsessed friends of mine have made me watch it. So I've seen this a few times, and like you said, it gets a little artsy-fartsy here and there, but I think it's not bad. I enjoy it, and it's nothing you can just like I don't know. It's not one to just like kind of throw on when you're just hanging out.
Right.
But I think it's worth watching.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of truth in the, you can't just throw it on if you want to hang out. Trying to rewatch this film, I did so at a friend's house who happens to have Netflix, and just mentioning, it's got David Bowie in it, Willem Dafoe's in it, as I remembered, but I just forgot how little of a party. It's one of those films that really loves to make use of slow motion.
Right.
Probably because it was only an hour long beforehand. They're like, well, let's stretch this out 30 minutes. So.
Right.
But yeah, I do enjoy it because of, some of the actors. I am one of those Bowie-obsessed people who just digs the fact that he's on screen doing something that isn't Labyrinth. and the middle is quite good. The beginning, not quite a Bauhaus fan myself, kind of wore on me the second time that I watched it. And the ending... too seems to, like I said, the slow-mo just drags it on forever, but still I think there's a lot worthwhile in it. You have a really great assembly of actors and actresses here, so
yeah. I think this would have made an excellent Tales from the Crypt episode. If they would have just condensed this to all the best parts of this and condensed it down to a half hour, I think it would have been like superb. But as is, like you said, it does drag a lot of parts with the slow motion and some of the artsy-fartsy stuff. But, then again, we are treated to a sweet lesbian love scene between Susan Sarandon and Catherine Deneuve. So you can't really complain about that.
From what I understand, they really changed the ending of the movie from the book, and I guess that was like a big point of contention between, I guess, everybody in the film. They wanted to keep it the same as in the book, but the studio wanted... her to be punished, and so they changed it, and I guess that nobody was really very satisfied with that.
Oh, yeah, that's a bummer.
Yeah. But the good news is, in September of last year, Warner Brothers announced the remake.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I guess that only makes sense with, you know, romantic vampire tales are all the rage these days.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. This is actually the one of the first movies ever directed by Tony Scott, who he kind of went on. He directed Top Gun, was his next film in 1986. He did a lot of big name stuff like Beverly Hills Cop 2, Days of Thunder, Last Boy Scout, and he did True Romance, which I really enjoyed. So
yeah, definitely.
So yeah, he definitely went on to a lot of acclaim. But yeah, this was kind of got getting his feet wet in the arty vampire film, which I find interesting.
Yeah, there is some over the top, like beat you across the head student art film shots in here, and cuts as well. Silly at points now upon rewatching it, but again, it's very fun just to see like a lot of these actors and actresses running around under the script. It's really good.
Yeah, now there are a couple things in this movie that kind of confused me a little bit, because from what we understand, you know, David Bowie, you know, the lovers that Miriam takes, they gain eternal life, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But they, to remain young, they, I don't get, like, what was the dynamic to keep them young? Because, I mean, I you see David Bowie starts aging rapidly, and there's a scene where there's a young girl that they give, like, violin lessons to that comes over, and, you know, he's contemplating killing her. Is that what would, you know, kind of reverse this rapid aging, as if he kills somebody young, or does he have to actually drink their blood? There's a lot of stuff that was very kind of ambiguous.
Well, I think it's the blood.
Okay. Because what confused
me, that's what I have always taken from it. You know, being vampires, I assumed that they gained something from blood.
Right. Well, I guess the reason I asked is what confused me is because he actually ends, spoiler alert, he does end up killing this young girl, but it doesn't seem to have any effect on this aging process.
And what I think it is that he doesn't start losing his hair in the movie, and this is like towards the first quarter of it. He doesn't start losing his hair in it and start this progressive aging until this shot where he and Miriam, John and Miriam, are watching television. Susan Sarandon's character, Dr. Roberts, comes on screen, and Miriam just sort of interlocks with this image of Dr. Roberts, and it just kind of goes back and forth. So I think it's whoever she, like the key to others' immortality around Miriam is only if they're in her favor, only if she considers them to be somebody she has to have.
Mm-hmm.
But once she kind of goes towards somebody else, then they start decaying.
Right. Okay. I see. And yeah, that's another really cool part of the movie, which I enjoyed. In addition to the really good aging effects that they do on David Bowie, she also has like this whole attic filled with the decaying corpses of her immortal ex-lovers, which
who aren't dead.
Right, you know, talking about, you know, having your exes come back to haunt you.
Yeah, exactly.
Cha-cha-cha.
Right, exactly. You mentioned earlier that Willem Dafoe does have a part in this movie, and, you know, it's one of those ones where if you blink, you miss it. He plays, like a young punk.
Phone booth.
Yeah, at a phone booth.
Number two.
Right, yeah, trying to get, is it Susan Sarandon? Yeah, off the phone at a phone booth when she becomes entranced in Miriam's tangled web of love and vampirism. But yeah, it's funny because I didn't even recognize Willem Dafoe as the phone booth punk at the time, but when I researched the movie later, I saw that it was him, and I actually had to go back and watch it again just to verify, but yeah, it is in fact Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, I definitely think that Willem Dafoe could have had way more screen time. The first quarter of it, and while it sets up, you know, the doctor's research, Susan Sarandon's research, there's just all these shots of primates, like, attacking each other or aging rapidly, and we could probably just sum that up, that she just studies aging, but instead we're treated to all these shots of monkeys jumping around and acting insane and aging really fast.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought that part was actually fairly interesting. I liked how they kind of interspliced, especially at the beginning, a lot of the, you know, kind of ambiguous arty vampire stuff with those raging apes with the red lighting and stuff. I thought that was kind of a cool way to juxtapose, you know, the hunger, the ravenous hunger of, you know, the vampire with kind of the, you know, animalistic side of these laboratory primates. So I thought that was an effective device. But yeah, the more that they go into that, and the more that they kind of show that I think that could have been trimmed down. Like I said, I think this would have been best as like a short film or like a television episode, something like Tales from the Crypt, where it was just concise and to the point. You know, keep the lesbian love scene, keep the David Bowie aging stuff, but kind of get rid of some of the more arty elements. And I think
I would keep Bauhaus too.
Yeah, no, by all means, yeah, go for it. I'm just glad
that would have made an amazing Tales from the Crypt episode.
Yeah, I'm just glad David Bowie didn't slide on the tight spandex pants from Labyrinth and wiggle his stick around.
He did actually learn to play cello for that though, which I think is cool.
Oh yeah, I was wondering about that. If that's something that he was actually able to do, or if that was dubbed over, because I mean, obviously he's a very musically inclined guy, so I figured it was him, but I didn't know if that was a talent he had already had, or if he learned that specifically for this movie.
Yeah, I guess he learned it for the role, so that's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. And David Bowie's film history is spotty at best. I mean, I like Labyrinth and, but The Man Who Fell to Earth, not...
That his scene in Fire Walk with Me, getting back to Twin Peaks, because... You know how we tie things together on this show. His scene in that movie is one of the best, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And also, his cameo appearance in Zoolander is probably my only favorite part about Zoolander.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I don't like Zoolander.
But yeah, and it's interesting to see, a young Susan Sarandon, well, I guess relatively young. I think she was almost 40 in this movie, but younger Susan Sarandon. I think this was, kind of when she was kind of coming into her own as an actress. It was, after the whole Rocky Horror days. And I think she does a really good job. I mean, great acting in it. I don't think anyone can fault this movie for poor acting. I think all the performances were really good. David Bowie was good, and Catherine Deneuve was especially good. But yeah, I mean, like I said, just maybe a little overlong, maybe a little too arty, but, we already did Ganja and Hess on this show, which was another kind of arty vampire movie. so I was kind of having like flashbacks to that a little bit when I was watching this.
Which did you like more?
Hard to say. I honestly think they're pretty much equal. Both these movies I would classify as, not great but interesting, worth a watch. I don't want to give the impression that I didn't like this movie, because I did. Especially because it really overshot my expectations. Because when I first started, I was convinced I was going to hate this thing through and through. But I actually really came around to it and really started to enjoy it. Especially, like I said, I don't know who did the makeup effects or anything in this movie, but a lot of the aging effects I thought were really cool. Anthony Clavet is the makeup artist. Oh, I guess he was actually a fashion makeup artist. Probably didn't have a whole lot of experience with makeup effects, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty convincing. I'd forgotten just how well done it was. And I remember there was, along with a special makeup effects artist, there's these makeup illusionists who appear, which I had never heard before this film. But they really do a great job of just making the agent appear nearly flawless. Like, I mean, obviously you can't tell it's Bowie, but for like a bald old guy with sagging features, it looks 100 times better than the Six Flags dancing old guy in the tuxedo who wears those giant glasses, if you've seen those commercials. There's a comparison made to that character, and it doesn't look anything at all like that. It doesn't look silly, goofy looking. It looks like a very old David Bowie who's lost all his hair.
Yeah. And it's interesting, I'm reading the trivia for this movie on IMDb, and it says that David Bowie, in order to make his voice hoarse for his aging scenes, stood on the George Washington Bridge at night and screamed all the punk rock songs that he knew, which that would be funny to be, in New York City walking home or something and seeing David Bowie on the George Washington Bridge screaming God Save the Queen or something.
Like any Iggy Pop song. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought that would be a strange scene to come upon.
All right. Well, that was The Hunger, and we'll be right back up for finishing comments after this break.
We'll be right back.
All right, well, that just about wraps up episode number 14 of Junk Food Dinner. I'd like to thank Jason Frisby for joining us this week. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks for having me again, Jim.
Yeah, absolutely. Good to have you. And next week, we will have the triumphant return of Parker from his new home in California. Next week, we'll be taking a look at Meatballs 3, Summer Job from 1986. Then we'll be taking a look at A Colt Is My Passport from 1967, a nice Japanese movie that Mark picked. And finally, we'll be looking at Meet the Hollowheads from 1989. So it should be a good episode, and it'll be nice to have our old pal Parker back in the fold. So definitely tune in for that. In the meantime, make sure you keep an eye on our blog at junkfooddinner.com. You can find all the latest updates from the world of Junk Food Dinner there. That's also, you can find links to subscribe to us on iTunes and Podcast Alley. If you haven't done so already, it's the easiest way to get the podcast delivered to your computer every week without you having to do anything. We just show up every week like your stoner friend that, you know, spends the night on your couch once a week. And so you can get us that way. Also, if you enjoy what we're doing, take some time to write a review or a comment on iTunes or Podcast Alley. Help spread the word about us. Also, if you want to get in touch with us, if you have a recommendation for a movie you'd like to hear us cover, or a theme episode, or if you just want to give us some feedback on how the show's going, please send us an email at jfdpodcast@gmail.com. But yeah, in the meantime, keep your eyes on the blog and on the website. Also, you can befriend us on Facebook and Twitter and all that good stuff, and your life can be filled with junk food dinner. So take those methods and get involved. So until next time, this is Kevin Moss for Jason Frisby and Mark Fredo saying adios, everybody.